From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, one of the finest broadcast journalists and one of the toughest reporters in the business. That's how Bob Woodward remembers Daniel Shore, who died last Friday at age 93. Shore covered Watergate for CBS, getting on President Nixon's enemies list in the process. And he broke many major stories, including a secret U.S. plot to assassinate Castro. He was a commentator on NPR for the last 25 years. We'll listen back to a 1994 interview with Shore, recorded on the 20th anniversary of Nixon's resignation. Also, Ken Tucker reviews Tin Can Trust, the new album from Los Lobos, and film critic David Edelstein tells us what life during wartime is like. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. The death of veteran newsman and NPR analyst Daniel Schorr last Friday evoked memories for anybody who's followed public life in America. Mine were from college when the Watergate scandal was unfolding, looking forward to the evening news every day to see Schorr's fearless reporting. Over his 70-year journalism career, Dan Schorr was tossed out of the Soviet Union for defying censors, fought to get stories on the air that made CBS executives uncomfortable, and pursued Watergate so doggedly that he made Richard Nixon's enemies list. He once said he was prouder of that than his three Emmy Awards. NPR was privileged to have Schorr as a news analyst for the last 25 years. Terry spoke to him in 1994 when he narrated a documentary about Watergate on the 20th anniversary of Nixon's resignation.
Do you think that the gravity of Watergate looks any different now in retrospect than it did to you at the time?
Well, I think people have tended to devalue Watergate by this device of adding the word gate to a lot of other things that have happened since. And, you know, you look back, and I can remember something called Korea Gate involving some bribery and corruption of congressmen by South Korea. I can remember something called, at one time, Billy Gate, which had to do with President Carter's brother having represented, without reporting the same, represented Libya and some things. And finally, Iran Gate, Iraq Gate, BCC Gate, and all kinds of gates. And if you add a certain number of gates in the end, they all seem to become trivial. But when you go back over Watergate, you realize that Watergate was the index against which all other scandals involving the White House have to be measured.
Well, what I want to do is talk with you a little bit about what your life was like covering Watergate for CBS TV. And I thought we could start with what had to be one of the most dramatic moments of your journalism career. And I'm thinking of when you were reporting live on Nixon's enemies list,
yes,
which I believe you'd just been handed.
Yes.
What happened when you got to enemy number 17?
Well, exactly. I mean, here was John Dean testifying in June 1973 before Senator Ervin's Watergate Committee. And in his testimony, he said that at the White House they had drawn up something called enemies lists, but he didn't read them, so that we waited until the end of the session to get the first copies of what had been submitted in evidence. And there we were outside the Senate caucus room waiting for the hearing to break so that we could get on the air. I say we, Sam Donaldson of ABC and Douglas Kiker, Sam Donaldson of ABC, Douglas Kiker of NBC, and myself, standing more or less shoulder to shoulder and talking into our own cameras, each wanting to be 2 or 3 seconds ahead of the other in revealing whom the Nixon people considered to be enemies. And so the thing was handed to me live on television. And I said, here it is, the first of the enemies list from John Dean. It's headed on screwing up political enemies. And let me begin to read it to you. I see there 20 numbered names. And went down the list and came indeed, as you suggested, to number 17, where it said, Daniel Schorr, a real media enemy. And I kind of gulped and went right down to the next name and down to the last name, which was Mary McGrory, and said, now back to you, trying as hard as I could to pretend that my name belonged to somebody else because I had suddenly been dragged into the story I was covering. And that is, for me, a real no-no. I mean, I want to stand outside, and they had pulled me inside.
Okay, so you tried to not reveal what you were feeling on the air, but what is it that you were feeling when you came up to number 17?
Well, what I was feeling, I mean, it didn't really bother me that I was on the enemies list, although it didn't occur to me that I was important enough in their terms to get on the enemies list. So astonished was the word for it, but much more because I had such a long life in journalism, from print to radio to television and all, that my standards were being violated. I'm supposed to be the observer, the fly on the wall, and suddenly I had to say my own name as part of the story that I was covering, and somehow the electrifying effect of having to deal with that professional problem overcame everything else.
Were you afraid you'd be taken off the beat?
We then said, in packaging it for the CBS Evening News, we just consulted and said, you better assign this part of the story to somebody else to do. I obviously can't do it. And that was obviously true.
So what were you doing on the list?
Well, it's very hard to say what I was doing on a list. I had some general idea Mind you, the list was drawn up in 1971. That's to say, the list was a pre-Watergate list. A lot of things were dug up during the Watergate investigation from the past. So the question was, what was it they had against me in 1971? Well, I had done a couple of stories in 1971 on CBS, which I know ruffled their feathers a little bit. I had reported that President Nixon had serious reservations about going ahead with the anti-ballistic missile system, which he had inherited from previous administrations. And since they were trying to get new appropriation for it, his reservations didn't ring very well and all, and they got very angry with me about that. There was also the fact that President Nixon made a speech in New York to a Catholic audience, to the Knights of Columbus, promising that he would find ways of giving federal help to parochial schools, although the Supreme Court had just come out with a decision saying that it was unconstitutional. And in analyzing what the meaning of the speech was, I'd have been asked by CBS to report what was it they were planning to do. And my inquiries indicated they weren't planning to do anything, and there wasn't anything they could do. And so I went on the air after a cut of Nixon getting wonderful applause from the Knights of Columbus, New York, and came right on and said, yeah, that's what he said, but we find no evidence that there is anything they're going to do or can do, and it is all simply political rhetoric. Well, that speech had been written by Pat Buchanan, and he didn't take very kindly to that. And as we subsequently discovered from many, many investigations, he then called President Nixon, who was traveling, and Nixon had somebody called J. Edgar Hoover, and that was how the FBI investigation of me started. But in 1971, I was simply covering whole aspects of what the Nixon administration was doing, which had to do with civil rights and had to do with housing and urban problems and all. And when I found that they were making promises and not keeping them, I had no hesitation in reporting that. And I guess no president likes it, but no president before has ever reacted so violently to it.
Some people who made it onto that enemies list considered it a badge of honor. Did you?
Oh, yes. Well, a badge of honor. It turned out to be very useful. First of all, by the time I was aware of the enemies list, I knew nothing ever was going to happen about it, although I had been audited rather curiously by the IRS. But yes, it was. There were buttons handed out by some well-meaning people that read Dean's List. And after a while, I found it was increasing my invitations to dinner parties that I like to go to and adding to my lecture fee. So, you know, as I recall, you know.
Boy, did they do you a favor.
Yeah, did they do me. And some of my colleagues who were not on the enemies list came to be a little resentful. Dan Rather, who had been covering the White House then, somehow didn't make it on the enemies list, and he didn't like that at all.
Now, President Nixon also ordered an FBI investigation of you on the pretext that you were in line for a top federal job, so of course they had to investigate you. How did you find out about this investigation?
Well, very simply. He had Haldeman have his assistant, Larry Higby, call J. Edgar Hoover and simply say, the boss, the president, wants to have some background stuff on correspondent named Daniel Shore. And apparently Hoover misunderstood, either really misunderstood or maybe mischievously chose to misunderstand. The word background is used by the FBI, is commonly used for background checks on people who are going to be nominated to presidential positions, presidential appointments. And so there apparently was some misunderstanding, with the result that the investigation that was ordered by Hoover was basically a wide-open investigation in which agents called up my employer, called up members of my family, and indeed sent an FBI agent up to CBS to interview me. And when I said, what is this all about? He said, presumably you know, these are usually done for pre-appointment investigations. I said, but nobody's offered me anything. When the word got back that this had happened, they quickly and rather precipitously called off the investigation and then began to have a damage control meeting as to what to do when the story came out. And so all those wonderful people, Ron Ziegler and Chuck Colson, all got together and they said, well, the only thing we can do is to say that he was under consideration for a job, however preposterous that may seem, and actually identify a job.
What job did they come up with for
It was a public relations person for the Council on Environmental Quality, which was then headed by Russell Train, who a long time later apologized to me profusely because he knew that he had been used for that purpose.
You must have been so amused thinking of the Nixon administration hiring you for a PR job.
Well, I didn't believe it, of course.
Yeah, no,
I never believed it, but they, with a straight face, they put out that story. And then in the end, what happened was that they had to testify under oath about it before the Senate Watergate Committee, and then again before the House Judiciary Committee, which was holding impeachment hearings. And they had to confess that the purpose of the investigation of me was quite adverse and that they had tried to cover it up. And all of that was confessed. And in the end, when the Judiciary Committee approved three articles of impeachment against Nixon, Article 2 was called abuse of power, and under that was listed the FBI investigation of me. So I became a part of the history of the impeachment of Nixon in that very odd way. You want me to tell you how that story ended many years later?
Sure.
Well, the interesting thing was that in the months before his death, Nixon and I had some kind of a reconciliation of sorts. I found myself being invited to small dinners where Nixon was giving briefings on his trips to the former Soviet Union. And at one of these, the first of these dinners, I was wondering if he remembered who I was or why I was being invited, and unable to resist that temptation, at the end of dinner, I went up to Nixon and I said, Mr. Nixon, I'm not sure you will remember me, but... And he interrupted me and he said, oh, sure, Dan, sure. Damn near hired you once.
Did he believe that?
No, he didn't believe that. That was his little joking way of trying to make up. I don't know. It was a quip. He said it with a smile. And I'm sure he had worked it out in his mind that he was going to say it to me. But the fact of the matter was he wanted to be forgiven or forgotten or whatever, and I found it not difficult to do that.
Why did you find it not difficult to do that?
Well, for one thing, because I had a certain amount of respect for his 20-year campaign after resignation to try to rehabilitate himself. He was a man who had done many comebacks, and I thought the toughest comeback of all was running for ex-president. And I had to respect that, and because, he who is without blemish should be casting stones around. I consider life too short to have grudges, retain grudges. And furthermore, I found him interesting, and he invited me to join a foreign policy institute that he wanted to plan in Washington. And as far as I'm concerned, anywhere I can go and talk to people who know something and help me in my work, well, why not? That was 20-odd years ago, and there's statute of limitations on all things.
Did you get your Freedom of Information Act files?
Yes, I did. I got my FBI file on a Freedom of Information application and found out step by step what had happened. What I also found out is that the FBI is not a very efficient organization. The first message in the file had to do with Hoover saying that giving orders for an expedite investigation that the White House wanted of me, and then added at the end that I was last identified as CBS correspondent in Germany, according to Who's Who. And so they were sending a message to the FBI representative at the American Embassy in Bonn. This, mind you, was 5 years after I had come back from Germany and had been on CBS television almost every night, and the FBI had no way to look me up except in Who's Who, an outdated Who's Who at that, which listed me as correspondent in Germany.
Daniel Schorr speaking with Terry Gross, recorded in 1994. We'll hear more of that interview after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're listening back to Terry's 1994 interview with veteran newsman and NPR analyst Daniel Schorr, who died last Friday. Schorr won 3 Emmy Awards for his coverage of the Watergate scandal.
You were working for CBS, mm-hmm. covering the story for mm-hmm. them. What was it like being a TV reporter covering Watergate? I mean, this really was the kind of story that required so much detailed investigative work. It wasn't a pictures kind of story.
That's a very perceptive question. For a long time, it was a newspaper story, a Washington Post story, but also New York Times, L.A. Times carried elements of it. And it was very, very tough for a while because I was not keeping up with the newspapers, which were on the whole doing a better job. Indeed, the first big thing that we did, I had a couple of small scoops of one kind or another, but not really very significant compared to the developing story. And in fact, probably the greatest contribution we made in the early days, that is before the 72 election, was a decision to assemble all the known material, everything that had been in newspapers elsewhere, and put on a very long two-part series on the CBS Evening News of about 9, 10, 11 minutes each. And we didn't claim that we were original on it, but we did claim to be telling the country what a lot of Washington Post readers knew, but the country didn't. And so that became our contribution, enough of a contribution, in fact, so that the White House, Chuck Colson, called Bill Paley, the head of CBS, and threatened him with loss of television stations and so on if he didn't stop doing this Watergate series.
And what was the response at CBS?
Well, alas, the response of Bill Paley was, the first piece had already been on a Friday night, and they billboarded the next big piece was Monday, and then it didn't go on Monday, and it went on Tuesday, considerably truncated on the orders, personal orders of Bill Paley.
Well, you must have been pretty angry about that.
Yes, indeed. We were all angry about that. I mean, this was not just myself. We all, it was a cooperative effort involving everybody in the Washington Bureau. And we were furious, yes. Particularly furious because CBS had been so good on Watergate up until that point and then sort of cracked at a crucial moment.
Did you ever worry about self-censorship, that you would not say things because of the damage that would be done to your reputation from the White House or the hurt that could come to your network because of a report?
I maybe should have worried about, a little more about it. Maybe I would not have been on the enemy's list or investigated by the FBI or called up and bawled out on midnight one night by President Johnson and once by President Kennedy. Maybe I should have paid more attention to the fact that these people don't really like being criticized that way, but I didn't. But my problems were very rarely with the government other than with Nixon. Problems tend to be more within your own organization. Imagine on one occasion when I came back after Nixon had resigned, I went on vacation, came back, and then a news story was starting. Revelations were starting to be made about the CIA and what it had been up to. And so I was assigned what I call the Son of Watergate correspondent job, and that was covering the investigations of the CIA. Well, just imagine, in the course of following the investigation by Congress of the CIA, there came a story that Bill Paley, had in the 1950s done a favor for his friends at the CIA, allowing them to use CBS cover for CIA agents. Unthinkable thing to do, and very endangering to CBS correspondents everywhere. I had the job of getting that on the CBS Evening News, and I did.
How'd you do it?
Well, I told them that the story was in the hands of the New York Times and that it was going to be in the papers tomorrow anyway, and isn't it better if we break our own story and convince the Cronkite Show Evening News people to do it? And there it was with a picture of Paley and my reporting and they giving his denial and all the rest of it. Later on, when I got into terrible trouble with CBS, Bill Sapphire wrote in the New York Times that my real trouble had been by revealing Paley's secret of his CIA connections, that he had never forgiven me for that. And that may be true.
Some people who were considered Nixon's enemies and who found that their phones were tapped or on the enemies list became very paranoid, I think, after that. You know, wondering, well, who's out to get me now? Who's tapping my phone now? Really, in a lot of ways, that was a very paranoid period because a lot of people were afraid that they were being followed by the FBI, even if they weren't. I'm wondering if you ever felt that there was a kind of permanent after effect on you of knowing that you really were being invested, investigated by the FBI, and you really were on a president's enemies list.
Well, no, because for one thing, it was so uniquely Nixon.
Mm-hmm.
And understand that it was in 1973 that we were finding out what had happened in 1971,
mm-hmm.
which meant that by the time we were finding it out, Nixon was already on the ropes. And one just simply tied that to that era. And when, you know, when President Ford took over and said that's the end of our national nightmare, we were all ready to believe that we would go back to some kind of normalcy, that we'd been through some nightmare, and I guess that was how we felt.
Daniel Shore speaking with Terry Gross in 1994. Shore died last Friday. You can hear Dan Shore remembrances from Scott Simon, Robert Siegel, and Susan Stamberg at our website, freshair.npr.org. We'll hear more of Terry's interview with Dan Shore in the second half of today's show. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from AMC with its new conspiracy series, Rubicon, where not every conspiracy is a theory, premieres this Sunday night at 8, 7 Central on AMC. From Angie's List, providing consumer reviews on local professionals from physicians and veterinarians to plumbers and roofers. Details at angieslist.com. And from Pabst Brewing, proud supporter of local artists nationwide and of the NPR All Songs Considered series, online at PabstBlueRibbon.com. This is NPR.
Coming up, Daniel Shore's lifelong love of reporting. We continue our 1994 interview with the late newsman. We'll hear about him being tossed out of the Soviet Union for defying government censors. Also, David Edelstein has a review of the new movie Life During Wartime, and rock critic Ken Tucker reviews a new CD from Los Lobos. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Today we're remembering veteran journalist Daniel Shore, who died last Friday. Shore had a long career at CBS and was an analyst at NPR for 25 years. Terry spoke to him in 1994 when he'd narrated a documentary about Watergate.
Daniel Shore, I'd like to talk with you a little bit about your early years, your coming of age, and your start in journalism. I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about the neighborhood you grew up in.
Well, I grew up in the Bronx in a semi-poor but respectable neighborhood. From a very early age, as far as I can even remember, journalism was all I wanted to do. And I remember the first money I earned from journalism when I was about 13 years old. We lived on the ground floor of a tenement. And one day I heard a big plop outside the window and looked out the window, and lying there was somebody who had fallen or jumped off the roof. So cool as a reporter ought to be, I waited for police to arrive, found out what I could, and called the local newspaper, which paid $5 for news tips, and dictated a story. And that was really, in a sense, a benchmark for what was to be my career, in that if you can see something which might affect you and find yourself not affected except wanting to know what it's all about so you can explain it to other people, I think that's the basis of a journalistic career. It is removing yourself from drama so you can describe the drama.
Well, you know, exactly. I mean, I'm thinking, how old were you when this happened?
13.
Okay, a lot of 13-year-olds would have been plagued by nightmares after seeing somebody fall to their death. And instead, you're doing investigative work and calling in the story.
Well, right. And that's how I've tried to have it be through most of my life, although people sometimes don't let it be that way. I got dragged into my Watergate story when I later on covered the CIA story. In the end, I found myself being threatened with a jail term for contempt of Congress when they demanded that I reveal where I got the report, a congressional report, which the House of Representatives had voted to suppress.
And parenthetically, I'll put in, that's had a lot to do with your falling out with CBS.
And that had a lot to do with my falling out with CBS, which it did not wish in 1976, when cable television was first beginning to come on. CBS did not want to be placed in an adversary position to Congress, which was beginning to pass legislation on that. So they were horrified to see me as a symbol of a confrontation between CBS and Congress, and they didn't like that.
Well, back to Dan Shore, the early years. I know your father died when you were young, and you had to go to work at an early age. What kind of jobs did you do when you were young?
Well, I delivered newspapers, which maybe was one way of approaching journalism. I sold magazines, the Saturday Evening Post and so on, and that kind of thing, earning as much money as I could because we really needed it. My mother, widowed, was working in the needle trades in New York. My younger brother had been very ill during most of his early life. And so money was really very important. I'm talking about depression years. I'm talking about 1929 and 30, 31. And in the end, I managed to get into City College, which was free, or I would not have gone to college at all.
Were your parents immigrants, or were
yes.
they born? So did
yeah.
they speak English well?
No. Well, I really don't remember how well my father spoke English, because I was about 5 when he died, and I have very little memory of that. My mother spoke with an accent for all of her life, although she pretty well educated herself and read a great deal and was very literate, but that accent remains. I guess maybe this is the time even to reveal that our name, when my parents arrived in New York from Russia, was not even Shore. It was a different name. My father gave his name on arrival. The officer said, "What's your name?" And my father gave it. The name was Chornomorets, which in Russian means Black Sea. And the immigration officer asked for it a couple of times, some of my mother told me, and unable to write it down, write down Shore, S-C-H-O-R-R, and said, "Mr. Shore, welcome to America."
Did you feel, in a way, that you had to be a journalist for your mother? A lot of
no,
what I mean is
no,
because what I mean is, you know, a lot of times when a kid is growing up who was born in America, sometimes that kid has to translate not only the language but a lot of the culture for the parent.
Well, that's right, and journalism didn't transfer very well into their culture. When my mother asked me at about 13, 14 what I wanted to be, and I said a journalist, she looked at me very disapprovingly. So you don't want something like lawyer or doctor with a degree, which is what Jewish kids did, you know, lawyer, doctor, those were the two things. And journalists didn't carry a degree. And in fact, I recall my mother saying to me, "Journalist, isn't that a little bit like show business?" at that time.
Little did she know.
Little did she know. But I said yes, and she came to she came to accept it. She came actually to be a little proud of it. She came to understand that journalism was A, respectable, and B, that you can make a living at it, more important.
So what did you read when you were young that made you so excited by the idea of journalism?
I'm not sure I needed to read anything to be excited by the idea of journalism. It was just somewhere in my blood or in my genes. I guess we don't use those scientific words anymore. But, for example, when I went to Hebrew school, I started a newspaper in the Hebrew school, a monthly paper. When I went to high school, DeWitt Clinton High School, I worked on the Clinton News. When I went to City College, I worked on the City College campus. And I don't ever recall it being even a conscious choice of any kind. There was never any profession that I rejected. I just was a journalist.
You know, this innate feeling that it was your job to detach yourself from what was happening and describe it, did that apply to very emotional things that were happening to you, too? Did you find yourself trying to distance yourself from that and describe it as well?
Well, that's interesting. That's interesting. It maybe gets us deeper into psyche than I really planned to go. But since you ask, I've wondered myself about it. I've wondered myself about this dispassionate, disinterested view that I have of world and dramatic events and sometimes tragic events. And wonder whether, unable to come to terms with the death of my father when I was very young, that I was able then to deal with my father's death by removing myself from it, and thus learned to remove myself from a great many painful things.
Daniel Shore speaking with Terry Gross, recorded in 1994. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Listening back to Terry's 1994 interview with veteran newsman and NPR analyst Daniel Shore, who died last Friday.
I think it was in 1953 that you were recruited by Edward R. Murrow for the CBS news team. I mean, this is the most celebrated news team in television history. What was it like for you? Did it feel worthy of the celebration?
Well, that was interesting, too. I had that. This is 1953, and I was working in Western Europe, living in Holland, working in Western Europe as a stringer for various New York Times, for Time magazine, and for CBS. And in 1953, February, there was an enormous storm that broke the dikes, something that hadn't happened in hundreds of years, broke the dikes in southern Holland. A large part of the country was devastated by a flood. And I did some fairly dramatic reporting on that for CBS as well as for others. And Murrow was impressed. He sent a cable, which read, "Would you at all consider, would you at all consider joining the staff of CBS with an initial assignment in Washington?" And so then I went to work for CBS, but I'll tell you, with some reservations. Those were the early days when a newspaper person thought of radio and television as not really quite journalism, but somewhere closer to show business. And I sort of worried a little bit about that, but I thought I would try it and see if it was possible to do. I must say that in the first days in Washington, Scotty Reston, a friend of mine in the New York Times, every once in a while would say to me, "Have you had enough?" And I said, "No, Scotty, maybe soon, but not yet," as though I was still giving it a trial. Well, trial at CBS lasted for 25 years, and I went open the Moscow bureau for CBS and came back and joined that group of people that Murrow would have at the end of the year discussing the affairs of the world. People revered to me, like Alex Kendrick and Howard Smith and David Schoendren, who maybe I revered less but respected all the same. And here was I feeling that I was really in very, very big and important company. And I can remember the first time I appeared on that show. I'd just come back from Moscow and appeared on this ad-lib show of an hour and a half. And when we just finished taping it, I was sitting there at the Circle Murrow sort of walked over and looked at me. He's a very understated man. Walked over and looked at me and said, "Sure, you'll do."
Did that feel really good?
That felt very, very good.
When you were covering the Soviet Union for CBS, you were eventually thrown out of the country. I think this was in 1957.
Right.
And you were denounced by Pravda as a provocateur,
right,
and adventurer. And I'm not sure I know what it means to be denounced as an adventurer.
Well, those are words which have sort of better meaning in Russian than they have in England, in English. It is sort of a synonym for provocateur, someone who's trying to stir up trouble. I had indeed made trouble. They had official censorship then. You had to submit your scripts, newspaper stories. You'd submit them and wait for them to come back, with sometimes things excised. Radio scripts you had to sort of submit and wait until they came back before you could broadcast them, sometimes missing your circuit, which wasn't wonderful. And that would irritate me, and at times when that would happen, I would go in and try to read my script anyway. Sometimes I'd read a script where a paragraph had been taken out, and I was particularly fond of that paragraph, so I'd read it anyway. And then I was warned that I was violating censorship. And I said, well, listen, I don't believe in censorship. And so that became a problem for them. And in the end, they would do things like having me arrested briefly on some trumped-up thing by the KGB as a warning, and then eventually decided enough was enough, in spite of the fact that I'd made history in the Soviet Union by doing the first ever television interview with a Soviet leader, Nikita Khrushchev. And so I thought maybe that would give me a little bit of protection. In the end, it didn't. In the end, when the KGB was mad at me, not even being identified with Khrushchev helped.
Through all your career as a reporter, you tried to keep yourself out of the story. And as an analyst, I mean, your thoughts are the story. Your analysis is the story.
But not my emotions.
But not your emotions. Right, right.
And I think that to sort of anticipate your question, but if I haven't anticipated right, you'll tell me. I think that news analysis goes along with objective journalism. Mm-hmm. As long as you say the way you think things are instead of the way you want things to be. Information has become simply altogether too complex for people to be able to understand without some help from people with backgrounds. So I don't regard news analysis on NPR or anywhere as being different from what I consider to be the objective journalism, which has been my idol.
So in other words, you're saying that you see analysis as being in part about synthesis, so that to help people make sense of a lot of facts and put them in some kind of context?
That's right. In the CNN age, in the age of CNN, where things are brought to you live, you can see happening everything that's happening and have everything there except understanding what it means. And I think the more live news people get, the more they need help in understanding it.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
Daniel Shore speaking with Terry Gross, recorded in 1994. Shore died last Friday. He was 93. In his sixth feature film, Life During Wartime, writer and director Todd Solondz returns to the New Jersey family of his third film, Happiness. The three sisters and their mother have left suburban New Jersey for Florida and California, where their lives seem even more untethered. Film critic David Edelstein has this review.
Todd Solondz is a skinny guy with a shock of hair and a droning voice that's oddly passionate. He writes deadpan comedies, the bleakest I've seen. His new film, Life During Wartime, is positively grueling. For better and worse, you'll never experience anything like this movie. It's a sequel to Solondz's 1998 film, Happiness, despite the fact that all the roles have been cast with different actors, who aren't much like their predecessors. The original focused on three disparate Jewish sisters living in New Jersey, one a mousy and miserable teacher, one the author of arty titillating short stories, and the third a chirpy housewife and mother. Happiness was a broad satire, with that ironic title hanging over it like a mushroom cloud. There were off-screen suicides, a murder, and a subplot about a psychiatrist, the husband of the housewife, who molests little boys. The tone of life during wartime fluctuates even more wildly, and I'm frankly still wrestling over its mix of humanism and grotesqueness, of stylized camp and acid realism. The feel is squirmy, malignant, close to David Lynch. It's largely set in Florida and L.A. and bears no traces of nature. In Edward Lachman's startling cinematography and Rochelle Berliner's production design, the world is artificially colored and overbaked. In Happiness, Jane Addams played the youngest of three warped sisters, Joy, and she was tremulous and sexy. But Joy is now the more damaged Shirley Henderson, who has a twittery child voice and a withered demeanor. Lara Flynn Boyle's sultry Helen is now Ally Sheedy, who's brittle and high-strung, hopelessly nihilistic, even in the lap of Hollywood luxury. Cynthia Stevenson's Trish has been elongated into Allison Janney, who seems even more encased in her bubble of obliviousness. Over an al fresco lunch, Trish tells Joy she's getting married again.
But don't you think you're maybe rushing things a bit? I mean, men are... I don't know. And after Bill.
Bill is totally different.
Still.
No. The past is the past. Dead, gone, wipe my hands, forgot. It's got nothing to do with me and the kids. We live in Florida now.
I'm sorry.
Just... Now, Harvey, on the other hand, well, he's not very attractive. He's older. He's not even that well off. He's divorced. Poor thing, had a horrible, horrible wife. But he's Jewish, he's pro-Israel. He did vote for Bush and McCain, but only because of Israel. He knows these people are complete idiots otherwise, so don't worry. Basically, he's just a plain, totally family-oriented kind of guy. He's a real mensch.
The Israel reference is purposeful. Stars of David, Israeli flags, images of battle in Gaza show up in the background and on TV screens. They're not belabored, only glimpsed. But this is the wartime of Solanz's title, borrowed from a Talking Head song, but given new meaning. Unacknowledged by these sisters is a world of bloodshed and tribal allegiances. In life during wartime, there are no male figures with power or stature. But Paul Rubens is shockingly vivid as the ghost of Joy's ex-boyfriend, who committed suicide over her and now reappears, either to plead for her affection or abuse her. Kieran Hines plays Trish's ex-husband, the pedophile, newly released from prison, who's making his way to see his estranged college-age son. In the last half hour, Solanz's focus shifts from the adults to Trish's two young children, freckle-faced Dylan Riley Snyder and Emma Hines. They're the ones who notice the war on TV, the sterility of their environment, the void in the grown-ups' lives, and they weep over the loss of moral authority. Though they're wildly different, there's a thematic connection between life during wartime and Steven Spielberg's Munich, with its protagonist who begs at the end for someone to restore his link to the world of the ancestors, because this world is rotting from within. The children's weeping is the one thread of hope, faint but insistent, in this all-enveloping bad dream, the feel-bad movie of the year. I didn't enjoy this movie. I mean, how can you? But my own faith is rekindled by Todd Solondz, who's found a form for the chaotic, contradictory impulses that we live with during wartime.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. There are several scenes from Life During Wartime at our website, freshair.npr.org. Coming up, Ken Tucker on the new album from Los Lobos. This is Fresh Air. Tin Can Trust is the name of the first collection of new original songs from Los Lobos in 4 years. The East L.A. band has been active since the 70s, and over the course of their career, they've done everything from opening for Bob Dylan, U2, and the Grateful Dead, to recording a tribute album to Walt Disney movie music. Rock critic Ken Tucker says the group's new album can stand with their best work.
I didn't say a word. It's only destiny I heard. The time had come for me to run away. Don't even turn around is what they say.
Los Lobos are masters of creating moods, of summoning up a setting and putting you in the center of it. From their major label debut, Will the Wolf Survive, to the new Tin Can Trust, the band has always sung about people who take their pleasures where they can find them, and who lead rich, imaginative lives. There's an entire world that opens up in the beautifully languid stroll described in one of the band's finest songs ever, On Main Street.
Nothing better than walking down the boulevard, feeling the sun on my face.
One of the most impressive things about this album is the way Los Lobos shifts between a hard-boiled realism and a free, open lyricism. I'm not entirely sure what the lyrics of Jupiter or the Moon mean, but I know that the gorgeously eerie soundscape the song creates, with its bluesy ease and lunar jazz coolness, is a world I want to live in for a while.
If I could, tonight and today, you know. If I could make stolen to gold, you know I would. Look for white up in the sky. Where have you gone? Gone so soon as Jupiter.
To be sure, there's a certain fatalism in some of Los Lobos' music. This album features two songs in which the narrators use the phrase burning down to describe a scorched earth approach to dispatching a troubled past in hopes of building a better future. Yet I can't think of an example over 30 years of music making in which this band has resorted to cheap cynicism or knee-jerk nihilism. Whatever melancholy or hopelessness that can creep into a song is always tempered by precise detailing. Whether it's a guitar line that lifts despair into a thing of beauty, or a lyric suggesting that any state of mind is more complex than mere depression.
When we were young, taking time to believe, only to survive, what you gotta believe, live only to survive, survive in this world, in this crazy life. Gotta give it a whirl. All my bridges burning, almost burning down. All my bridges burning, burning to the ground. It's burning down, burning down.
Los Lobos saved their most audacious song for the end of this album. Called 27 Spanishes, songwriters David Hidalgo and Luis Perez describe it as an attempt to tell, quote, the entire tale of the Spanish conquest of Mexico, blow by blow. I'm staggered to hear that they come awfully close to achieving just that, encased in a quiet, lean, mean blues epic.
27 Spanishes arriving from the sea. Blades of steel flashing.
There isn't a false note on Tin Can Trust. It moves with the assurance of men who have the confidence to follow the path a stray guitar or keyboard riff may take them, pursuing the implications of a simple but tricky phrase like Tin Can Trust. They let the listener fill in the blanks about what guitars, keyboards, accordion, fiddle, and some blunt yet poetic phrases have to say about the lives they see around them and the lives we all live.
Ken Tucker is editor-at-large at Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed Tin Can Trust, the new album from Los Lobos. You can listen to every track from the album on nprmusic.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham, with additional engineering support from Joyce Lieberman and Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Melody Kramer is our associate producer of online media. Sue Spolin directed the show. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the Pew Charitable Trusts, working through its Pew Health Group to help families gain access to safe, affordable financial products at pewtrusts.org. From the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, working to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. And from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, writer Gary Steingart's new novel is a romance set in a future New York City where America is in chaos. We're at war with Venezuela, corporations have merged beyond recognition, and armies of the poor have taken over Central Park. The book is called Super Sad True Love Story. Join us.